This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, November 13th, 2009. From New York City, I'm Doreen Marina. Coming up on today's newscast, congressional Democrats are poised to make too big to fail a thing of the past. Attorney General Eric Holder announces civilian trials for 9/11 suspects held at Guantanamo Bay. And a former U.S. ambassador stands to profit on Iraq oil contracts. We'll take a look at the oil business in Iraq ahead of an important auction next month.
U.S. oil companies are shouldering their way into contract negotiations that Saddam Hussein had begun with every oil company just about, except for U.S. and British oil companies.
Those stories and more right after the headlines.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Secretary of Homeland Security Janet Napolitano today cleared the way for movement on immigration reform, announcing that the U.S. has met many benchmarks involved in border security. At a speech given Friday morning at a Center for American Progress event, she said what she'd seen makes reform far more attainable this time around.
Over the past year, as this administration has pursued more effective strategies within the current laws, the picture of how exactly those laws need to be changed has become clearer than ever before.
Napolitano indicated work would begin early next year. The U.S. Department of Justice has initiated seizures on four mosques in the U.S. and a skyscraper owned by a Muslim nonprofit group in New York. Federal prosecutors say the owners, the Alavi Foundation, is funneling its profits to the Iranian government, which violates a U.S. trade ban with the country. The DOJ says they are seeking to take control of building ownership, but that there are no complaints against the tenants themselves. President Obama is on a diplomatic trip through Asia, stopping today in Japan to try to smooth over an increasingly strained relationship with the island nation. One longstanding issue is the controversial presence of a U.S. military base on Okinawa. Obama will continue his travels over the next week with stops in China, Singapore, and South Korea. In the last 5 days, militants have attacked five different places in Pakistan's northwest province. Today, a suicide bomber attacked an intelligence agency office in Peshawar, killing at least 10. Nathan Moore reads for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan.
The suicide bomb in Peshawar exploded as intelligence employees arrived at the office. Black smoke filled the sky and debris littered the area surrounding the building. Residents report hearing the blast from miles away. It was so large it shattered the windows of nearby schools and offices. After the explosion, Sajjad Khan rushed to a local hospital where the injured were taken.
I'm searching for my relatives and brother who left early to go to the office. My mother is more worried than anyone else. I tried to look for them at the blast site, but I wasn't allowed. I can't find them here in the hospital, and I'm afraid. I pray for their safety.
Local residents and witnesses are thankful for one thing. The intelligence office is on a road used by dozens of children on their morning commute to school. If the bomb had exploded just a few minutes later, they would have been caught by the blast. Nathan Moore, reading for Gabe Matthews in Pakistan.
As President Barack Obama continues to weigh whether to send 40,000 more U.S. troops to Afghanistan, U.S. and NATO forces in the country continue to be the target of suicide bomb attacks. Today, a car bomb detonated near a main U.S. military base on the edge of the capital, injuring more than a dozen people, including some NATO soldiers. FSRN's Kabul-based reporter Mujahid Jawad reports.
The bomb targeted a NATO convoy, and while no U.S. and NATO troops were killed in the blast, a spokesperson for the Interior Ministry says five Afghan civilians died. Nawab, who lives in a town outside Kabul, witnessed the attack.
The blast was very strong, and I saw human remains everywhere. Both Afghans and foreigners were among the injured. I myself held pieces of human flesh in my hands. It was very bad.
Taliban have claimed responsibility and identified the suicide bomber. This was the second attack in Kabul in the past month. Mujahid Jawad, FSRN, Kabul.
Today, Germany announced it would send extra troops to Afghanistan to join NATO forces there. And in London, Prime Minister Gordon Brown said Britain would send more troops if NATO allies did the same. For more on the NATO position on Afghanistan, we go to Edinburgh, where the 55th NATO Parliamentary Assembly began today. Hundreds of member country delegates attended, as well as representatives from countries like Pakistan and Afghanistan, which are high on the political agenda. The assembly is billed as an opportunity for democratically elected representatives to have input into NATO's broad strategic goals, but not everyone is welcoming them to the Scottish capital. FSRN's Tom Allen reports.
Protesters shout abuse at NATO parliamentary delegates leaving the Edinburgh International Conference Centre. Earlier, masked protesters clashed with police as they tried to make their way here to disrupt the conference using direct action. These protesters didn't want to reveal their names.
I believe that NATO is bad. They're sending troops into Afghanistan, they're responsible for the killing of innocent people, and here they are having a conference right behind us in Edinburgh, and I'm not very happy that they're in my city, and I'd like them out.
Inside the conference, Assembly President John Tanner defended the military action, saying that evil had to be defeated. Although public displays of dissent in the UK, including the protests today in Edinburgh, have been limited, the war in Afghanistan is becoming increasingly unpopular, as British forces suffer a steady increase in casualties. Tom Allen, FSRN, Edinburgh.
And finally,
the very last seconds of the Shepherding spacecraft trajectory as it approaches the lunar surface. We are seeing very small craters.
We confirm a thermal signature of the crater. Over.
That's a transmission last month from NASA as they crashed a missile and research craft into the surface of the moon. Their hope was to send a plume of material into the air and analyze its composition. Today, they announced their findings. There is water on the moon. And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News from Eugene, Oregon. I'm Jess Burns.
This is Doreen Marina in New York. Five defendants charged in connection to the September 11th attacks, including alleged mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, will be tried in a Manhattan federal court rather than in military commissions. Attorney General Eric Holder made the announcement earlier today in Washington, D.C.
After 8 years of delay, those allegedly responsible for the attacks of September the 11th will finally face justice. They will be brought to New York, to answer for their alleged crimes in a courthouse just blocks away from where the Twin Towers once stood. I am confident in the ability of our courts to provide these defendants a fair trial, just as they have for over 200 years. The alleged 9/11 conspirators will stand trial in our justice system before an impartial jury under long-established rules and procedures.
Attorney General Holder says he expects to direct prosecutors to seek the death penalty for all five defendants. While in U.S. custody, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was subjected to waterboarding 183 times. Attorney General Holder added that the decision on whether to proceed in federal courts or military commissions was based on a protocol developed by the Departments of Justice and Defense.
Because many cases could be prosecuted in either federal courts or military commissions, that protocol sets forth a number of factors, including the nature of the offense, the location in which the offense occurred, the identity of the victims, and the manner in which the case was investigated.
Cases that will go to the military commission system include those of detainees accused of a role in the attack on the USS Cole in 2000. Too big to fail could become a thing of the past if some congressional Democrats get their way. They're tapping into deep and widespread outrage at how the risky behavior of financial firms led to the economic collapse. But big businesses say they're big for a reason, and they're trying to bring lawmakers around to their side. Tanya Snyder reports from Washington.
Friday marks the 10th anniversary of a landmark day in financial regulation and, according to many, a precursor to our current economic ills. On November 13, 1999, Congress repealed the Depression-era Glass-Steagall Act, which had put a firewall between commercial banks and investment companies. Rob Weissman, the president of Public Citizen, wants to bring Glass-Steagall back.
The basic idea embodied in Glass-Steagall was that commercial banks, especially because they have a federal guarantee for their depositors, should not be engaged in the kind of risky speculative ventures that characterize investment banking. It was not just by adopting rules and regulations, but just by mandating that the two enterprises be separate.
One of the catchphrases of this recession has been too big to fail, referring to financial institutions that are so big or so interconnected that their collapse could bring the entire financial services system down with them. The too big to fail label has come with a sort of automatic government bailout insurance. Enter Congressman Paul Kanjorski, a Pennsylvania Democrat on the Financial Services Committee. Here he is on CNBC last Friday.
If we're going to give power to bail out companies when they are too large, and we're going to give power to do resolution authority once they go over the edge and we have to say them, well, why don't we preemptively determine those corporations or financial institutions that are, quote, too big to fail, identify them, and then make sure they don't remain too big to fail, trim them down so that they can sail and fail if they want to, but not cause the entire system to fail.
Kanjorski is about to introduce an amendment to financial reform legislation pending in the House. His amendment would go farther than most other proposals on the table in that it would give the government authority to preemptively break up financial institutions that are considered too big or too interconnected to fail, even if those institutions still seem to be healthy. Senator Bernie Sanders has already offered a similar amendment, which would break up all firms on the Fed's too-big-to-fail list. Rob Nichols is the president of the Financial Services Forum, which represents some of those big players.
Large institutions provide significant value in the sheer size of loans that they can deliver, in the array of products and services they can provide, obviously their geographical reach that small institutions simply can't provide.
Companies like the ones Nichols represents haven't been shy about their opposition to Kanjorski's amendment and all the other proposals to break up large firms. JPMorgan Chase, Citigroup, and MetLife are just a few companies that are pounding the pavement on Capitol Hill these days. Sheila Krumholz directs the Center for Responsive Politics, a watchdog group that follows the money in Washington.
The finance, insurance, and real estate sector has always been the major source, both for campaign contributions and for spending on lobbying. And over the last decade, it's the number one sector spending $3.8 billion on lobbying.
Not all of their lobbying is about financial regulatory reform. Big corporations are also worried about healthcare and climate change legislation. The health industry has eclipsed the financial sector lately as reform has moved through Congress. But Krumholz says the financial sector is in high gear too.
Well, they know that they're on the table, on the chopping block in Congress. They're facing the biggest increase in regulation probably since the Great Depression. Of course, this has been a long time coming, many say, this re-regulation of Wall Street.
She says the companies are looking for access to lawmakers as they shape this legislation. Senator Chris Dodd revealed his plan to regulate the financial sector on Tuesday. Kanjorski is expected to introduce his amendment in the next week or two with the support of Committee Chair Barney Frank. Tanya Snyder, FSRN.
A former American ambassador who shaped the policy in Iraq stands to profit from oil contracts in that country. Peter Galbraith was an ambassador to Croatia and the former number two official with the UN mission in Afghanistan. He was also a key advisor to the Kurdish regional government as Iraq wrote its constitution. The New York Times reports that Galbraith could now earn around $100 million from oil contracts through a Norwegian company, thereby benefiting from a policy that he himself helped create. Galbraith has denied any wrongdoing, saying he was a private citizen when the deals were finalized. But the disclosures bring up serious questions about foreign oil interests in Iraq. Earlier this month, when ExxonMobil won a $50 billion contract to develop an oil field in Basra, we spoke to Charlie Cray from the Center for Corporate Policy. This is what he said on FSRN.
This is a foot-in-the-door type of arrangement for particularly ExxonMobil. It's the first time that a U.S.-led multinational oil consortium is inking a deal with the Iraqi oil ministry.
Today, we are joined by Antonia Juhas. She is the director of the Chevron program at Global Exchange and the author of The Tyranny of Oil, the World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It. It's coming out in an updated version in December. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks for having me.
First, the current case of Ambassador Galbraith. He has written on policy in Iraq for the New York Times. He was on staff of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. He's said to have influenced the thinking of Vice President Joe Biden and Senator John Kerry on Iraq. Is this a cause for concern?
It's certainly a cause for concern, but it's also just quite emblematic of the direction that the entire U.S. government and oil industry has been leading and walking since the invasion of Iraq, and that has always been with oil front and center in the discussions, in the agenda, in the framework. And it is very unfortunate that there is this direct financial link for Ambassador Galbraith, but not at all surprising that, you know, in his role as advisor, chief in his interest was looking at the potential benefits for the private oil industry in the outcome of the Iraq war. And, his particular focus was in the Kurdish region, but this has been, you know, obviously as front and center in the negotiations and the pursuit of, the outcome of the invasion in Iraq proper as it has been in the Kurdish region.
Is the case of Ambassador Galbraith unique, or do you see it as part of a larger systemic problem in the region?
I think this direct financial benefit is most likely unique, hopefully unique, hopefully isn't being replicated with any of the other advisors involved. But it's emblematic of the mess of negotiations as they are playing out in Iraq.
Well, a major auction for oil contracts will take place in Baghdad next month. What's at stake there, and who are the major players?
For the first time in 6 years, we're seeing the oil companies, big oil, come to the table and sign contracts in Iraq. And the Iraqi government has actually been trying to get foreign oil companies to sign contracts essentially for 6 years, and they've been unwilling to do so because they have been waiting for passage of the Iraq oil law and have refused to sign contracts without the oil law's passage. So they're now coming to the table. And what's at stake is all of the largest oil fields essentially left in the world that are on the table. We're seeing now for the first time Exxon, BP, Shell signing oil contracts with Iraq, waiting for the next round of negotiations are Chevron, ConocoPhillips, all the major U.S. oil companies, all the major British oil companies, and they are teaming up with a sort of odd selection of oil companies for them, such as China's oil companies and Russia's oil companies, mostly because what's happening at this point is U.S. oil companies are essentially shouldering their way into contract negotiations that Saddam Hussein had begun before he was removed, with every oil company just about except for U.S. and British oil companies. So now, thanks to the war, U.S. and British oil companies are now part of those deals. And now also, thanks to the war, the sanctions are over with and those contracts can start to be implemented.
We've been speaking with Antonia Juhas about oil contracts in Iraq. She's the director of the Chevron program at Global Exchange. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
World leaders are gathering in Copenhagen next month to develop a plan to fight climate change. While many countries are calling on rich nations to reduce their carbon emissions, some, like the U.S., are looking at alternatives, including weather modification. But as FSRN's Christina Anastad reports, one community in Northern California is resisting a strategy called cloud seeding.
Bernie Falls is mostly forest and timberland. It's also where PG&E, one of the nation's largest power companies, wants to modify the weather.
There are very simple devices. Cloud seeding generators such as this have existed for many decades. in California cloud seeding of this type has been done for well over 50 years.
Paul Moreno is a PG&E spokesperson. Pointing to a cloud seeding generator, he says the device will spray silver iodide into the air, which then acts like a magnet, attracting ice particles until snow forms. The purpose? More water for PG&E's hydropower project in the Pitt and McLeod River watersheds. Again, Moreno.
With this cloud seeding project, it will stimulate about an additional 5 to 8% snowfall or water. That will generate an additional 175,000 gigawatt hours of electricity per year. That's a considerable amount of electricity that we don't need to generate by fossil fuel power plants.
There are about a dozen cloud seeding projects in California, mostly in the Sierra Nevada mountain range. The U.S. military is also researching the use of cloud seeding. A 1996 document called Weather as a Force Multiplier, Owning the Weather in 2025, states weather modification can be used in, quote, war-fighting applications and to, quote, achieve military objectives. One of their methods includes using radiation like ultraviolet rays and microwave beams to simulate weather conditions. China and Saudi Arabia also use weather modification. In the U.S., weather modification is usually achieved by using generators or airplanes to spray chemicals like silver iodide into the atmosphere. The process has raised concerns with area residents.
It's never been proven to actually work.
Matt Ryan is a resident of Siskiyou County. He's worked as a weather consultant for 25 years.
The idea that you can drug the sky into dropping more rain on you is part of the problem in and of itself. Silver iodide, which is the drug of choice throughout the cloud seeding industry, is a Class C toxic, non-soluble, inorganic chemical. When they say that it's a Class C, it means that you can't flush this down a drain. It's toxic.
But it's not a serious threat, according to Brant Foote, who heads the Research Applications Lab for NCAR, the National Center for Atmospheric Research in Colorado. He's studied cloud seeding for decades.
In general, what we have shown is that the health hazards of cloud seeding are negligible.
But Foote seems less certain about whether cloud seeding actually works.
It's been a tough nut to crack. There have been a lot of attempts to evaluate cloud seeding, and more often than not with inconclusive results rather than with either negative or positive.
That's not stopping PG&E from pursuing cloud seeding. To fast-track the process, Moreno says the company will not be filing an environmental impact report and that the state and federal governments haven't asked for one. That has raised concerns with climate activists. Angelina Cook is with the Climate Council in Mount Shasta City.
I think it's ridiculous. I think private corporations require more government oversight and more regulation to ensure accountability for their practices. When private corporations are allowed to manipulate a common good, such as water or weather, that means that they should be held to the highest standards. And if they're not even being held to the same standards as municipalities, and that is a blatant injustice. And it's very concerning to me that California would have such a policy.
There is no federal law governing weather modification, and state laws vary. California law does not require environmental impact reports from private companies when it comes to weather modification. In response, Cook says she's working on a countywide ban on cloud seeding through a ballot initiative. Despite concerns, the state of California plans to pursue weather modification as part of its 2009 water plan. The plan estimates cloud seeding could provide up to 400,000 acre-feet of water annually, a 4% increase. The cost? A little over $100 million over 25 years. PG&E says it hopes to begin its cloud seeding project in the winter of 2010. Christina Onnestad, FSRN, Northern California.
At least 90% of water in the Gaza Strip is not fit for human consumption. That's according to a recent report by Amnesty International. The water infrastructure in the coastal territory is both outdated and severely damaged by military actions. But the Israeli blockade prevents the passage of equipment to upgrade and repair Gaza's dilapidated water system. FSRN's Rami Almagari files this story from Gaza City.
At the Beit refugee camp in western Gaza City, wastewater is pumped into Gaza Sea. All day long, the brownish-gray liquid flows into the sea, contaminating the water and preventing residents from fishing and swimming in the area. But Gaza's water problems do not stop here. Residents complain about the quality of water they receive in their homes. Mahmoud Ali is a resident of the Beit refugee camp. He buys filtered water due to the contamination.
We don't even use it for washing. One's hair drops out sometimes. Please look at it, how strange it looks.
The World Health Organization in Gaza says they have observed deterioration of water quality in Gaza for the past few years. They confirmed two types of groundwater contamination, biological and chemical. According to a WHO spokesperson, 500,000 cubic meters of water are contaminated due to the destruction of the wastewater network, primarily in northern Gaza, during the 22-day-long Israeli attack last January. Large quantities of wastewater that used to be pumped through the wastewater networks are now seeping into the groundwater. Mahmoud Dahir is a spokesperson for the WHO in Gaza.
This is critical if we look at any effect of water problems in Gaza Strip and its effect on the human being. We in WHO with other UN agencies are going to look at some of the aspects of the water contamination. There was a report from the United Nations Environmental Program assessing the situation of the environmental issues, including the water, after the war in Gaza, and the recommendations to have a further study, for example, on the effect of the increased nitrate level.
Dahir also says that tests in 2008 showed that 70% of Gaza's water has more nitrates than the accepted standards of the WHO.
We don't have accurate statistics about diarrheal diseases. For example, we noticed that there is an increase in the diarrheal diseases reported to UNRWA clinics in times of the year. And we notice some episodes here and there in some areas of hepatitis A, for example, or other types of waterborne disease.
The coastal municipality's water utility in Gaza confirms that Gaza's water is not safe to drink. The utility says there is a deficit of water for Gaza's 1.5 million residents. Mondar Shiblak is the Director General of the Coastal Municipality's Water Utility in Gaza.
The lack of proper wastewater treatment in Gaza is a direct cause of nitrate contamination. Only 70% of Gaza residents have wastewater networks going into their households, while 30% depend on wastewater absorption wells that have intruded into the groundwater. The other reason is that waste treatment plants are not functioning properly and are only able to treat 30% of Gaza's wastewater.
The utility also says that the Israeli authorities continue to block groundwater from shared aquifers that come through the nearby West Bank areas, adding to the water problem in Gaza. According to Shiblak, unless Israel lifts the blockade on Gaza and allows building materials and spare parts into Gaza, wastewater treatment or disposal cannot be upgraded. Rami Al-Mighari, Free Speech Radio News, Gaza.
And that wraps up today's program. This is Free Speech Radio News. Thanks for listening. In New York, I'm Doreen Marina.